Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:32 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is May 26th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought we'd kick off with the FAANG MAN relative to the total market cap ratio. It has popped up to a new all-time high as of today. So that is eight companies representing 24% of the total market cap of the entire U.S. market. And that's pretty substantial. Now, considering the fact that it peaked in the middle of 2020 and then declined quite sharply in 2022, this is really quite a phenomenal rebound since the beginning of this year. And it is owed almost entirely to the performance of companies that have got a strong position in artificial intelligence. Now, one thing that I would hasten to add is that artificial intelligence is not a new phenomenon. It has been around for most of the last decade, and it has been named by, or it has been referred to by various names over the course of this decade. So there was deep learning, there was big data, and now we have large language models. But the one thing they share in common is the need for large quantities of well labeled data and then massive computing power. So those two important factors are driving the way to invest to, along following the enthusiasm that has arrived as a result of the large language models and the impressive capabilities of ChatGPT 3, and then the big leap ahead from ChatGPT 4. Now, of course, that momentum will have to be continued in subsequent iterations. And of course, it is going to become progressively more difficult to iterate on, but we shall see what happens. Then, of course, we also need to think about, well, how big a deal is this? So, it's a pretty big deal. There are certainly use cases that are very well defined. And one thing that I think is most particularly relevant here is that it's easy to understand where those use cases are. So, ChatGPT could be used in preference to a regular Google search. It can be used as a way of writing and coming up with novel interpretations. And then there are obviously the additional uses from a creative perspective. So we have art that can be created by artificial intelligence. We can have music that can be created. And one would argue, I think that, and it is reasonable, I think, to argue that the fact that a lot of art is iterative, and the fact that a lot of new music composition is achieved by following a formula, that's certainly something that I think is very relevant here. That anyone who was thinking perhaps that they could survive without ever really having to justify where their creativity comes from is going to be in for a rather big surprise. So obviously, all of that contrasts really quite, I think, sharply with Bitcoin. So Bitcoin has also been one of these markets that has been capable of inspiring a great deal of enthusiasm among investors over the course of the last 15 years. And we've had some really spectacular advances. This is the log scale chart since 2010, for example. But despite the fact that we are 15 years into this bull market in cryptocurrencies, there is no killer app. And it's very hard to delineate exactly where the use case is. And a lot of the use cases that are preferred seem to be rather contrived. And yet, there's still a huge amount of enthusiasm. So I remain very much of the view that Bitcoin is a liquidity barometer, and that it was mostly a response to the massive monetary and fiscal accommodation that greeted the credit crisis. So, in that respect, it tends to do well when the limited supply argument are really bolstered. That should probably reach another peak at some point next year. I think there is one thing that is very cyclical about Bitcoin is that it has a four-year cycle. Then the other big four-year cycle is the presidential cycle. And the worst year of the presidential cycle generally tends to be between the middle of the first year and the middle of the second year after an election. So that I think is worth considering here. Now we are in the third year of the US presidential cycle. That's generally the best. And the stock market is taking off right now. So one would have to argue that perhaps this is the third year of the US presidential cycle. And investors might be betting, although I haven't heard a lot of commentary about it, that the Fed isn't going to be able to continue to tighten and that they won't risk a recession heading into an election year next year. And instead, it is more likely that the debt deal that is reached at some point over the next couple of weeks will probably be accommodative enough. And that, I think, is also feeding through into enthusiasm for the stock market. Now, when we look at the NASDAQ 100, it popped on the upside in really quite dynamic form in here this week. I've closed out my short position. It was clearly going in the wrong direction. And now we're clearing the 14,000 level. So it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. It has confirmed support in the region of both the 1,000-day and 200-day moving averages. It's held the sequence of higher reaction lows since October, and now it is accelerating away from the moving average here. So this, I think, is very important. We're definitely getting a great deal of enthusiasm. Now, I think it's maybe if let's just put some numbers on all of this. So we had a really significant decline in 2021 through to 2022, and that shaved 37% off of the index. And to date, it has rallied very impressively by about 37%. Now let's just pull this back and look at what happened with the NASDAQ 100 back in 1999, and I will zoom in just to show that a little bit clearer. So when we peaked in the early 2000s, it declined by 39%. And then the counter trend rally went up 43%, and subsequently then fell substantially more. Why do I highlight that correspondence? I really think that the challenge here is that we still have tightening liquidity conditions. So when we think about the yield curve spread, it is very inverted, and it took a leg lower again in here today. So the trend is still downwards, and this yield curve spread generally tends to go in three phases. At the beginning of the inversion process, you get investors worrying, and they're worrying that the inflationary pressures are out of control, that the Federal Reserve isn't acting quickly enough. So they want to see interest rates hiking, and that's what happens. Then, because interest rates go up, then that creates some demand for treasuries and for alternative securities like money market funds. And but what it also does is it helps to get inflationary pressures under control. So then investors are enthused by that. So then whatever little wobble we get at the beginning of the inversion turns into a rebound in confidence that the Federal Reserve is going to do what is necessary to get inflation under control. And the yield curve continues to contract. Well, then eventually they do too much, and they raise rates too aggressively, and the variable and lagged effects of monetary tightening start to come to bear or bear fruit, and then subsequently we get an economic contraction. And at that point, it is when the Federal Reserve panics and starts cutting rates. And they do that aggressively, and then we start talking about bailing out the banking sector via the yield curve. And that's exactly what happened, for example, in 2008 and 9. And aggressively cutting interest rates, introducing quantitative easing, suppressing the yield at the longer end of the curve while cutting interest rates at the short end creates ensured that there was a wide interest rate differential and a wide yield curve. That's exactly what happened. So it got up to 300 basis points or close to, and over the course of several years bailed out the banking sector because it also forced them to take their losses. Well, we're not there yet, and the banking sector is was steadier in here this week, but it remains under pressure. And it remains under pressure because they're sitting with a large number of treasuries on their book. And the very significant challenge is that whatever the debt deal that is agreed over the course of the next week, then the one thing that we can be absolutely assured of is that the US government is going to be issuing a lot more debt. So 3-month yields are up to over 5%. And as recently as yesterday, there were yields for bonds that are going to be maturing over the course of the next 3 weeks as high as 6 and even 7%. So there's certainly some angst around the question of whether a deal will in fact be done. I think it's very likely that a deal will be done. And I don't think anyone's going to be happy about it. But we can certainly look at, for example, the performance of the defense stocks. And Northrop Grumman has broken lower, and it's a pretty similar story of underperformance for Lockheed Martin as well. And that is pricing in the real possibility that the needed increase in, or significant increase in supply for various armaments that are in danger of being exhausted in Ukraine may not happen, or that it will, or that other things might get reprioritized in order to ensure it happens, but that the total spending will not go up more than was anticipated, and it might even fall. So that's one potential outcome from the debt ceiling negotiations. There is another, is that the possibility is that the student loan forgiveness will fall by the wayside, and that would probably be a good thing because it's probably illegal to begin with. So there will be some fiscal constraint. And then when we think about what that could mean, well, fiscal constraint in any way, shape, or form should help to support the dollar. And when we think about what is supporting the dollar, well, if the USA is going to introduce even a modicum of fiscal restraint, that's positive. But then on top of that, there is obviously continued demand for money market funds. And then we can think about the fact that bond yields continue to rise. Because if they're going to be issuing a lot of debt, well, then that's going to put upward pressure on yields. So we are in a rather interesting situation where not only do we have high interest rates and inflationary pressures that have been stubbornly high, and the PCE deflator was above the consensus survey in here today. So, not higher by a lot, but certainly not contracting. And we also saw that the economy is still in pretty robust form, that the University of Michigan sentiment indicator is well above 50, and that durable good orders are also coming in above expectations. So there was a lot of data points in here today, and then personal spending was also higher. So what this is telling us is that we have tightening liquidity conditions against a background where money supply might be now negative, but it's important to highlight that even though this is the first time ever that the money supply has actually contracted and is falling on a year-over-year basis by about 4%, It's coming from an exceptionally high nominal level and only really just beginning to contract. So even to just get back to trend, it could fall really quite meaningfully from here. And that's probably what's going to be required in order to snuff out some of the inflationary pressures that we've had, just really an incredible amount of money printed during the pandemic and all the way through into 2022. So that's why spending is still firm. It's why there is still a lot of enthusiasm around the bull market in stocks, because while and I think we can easily see that. But then I think what was also interesting today is corporate profits were updated. And we don't get this data all that often. So I think it is worth paying attention to when we do get it. Now, the other thing is that it tends to be revised. So whenever the next one is released, and it'll be 3 months from now, the chances are that the total figure on this occasion will be revised. So, but one thing that we can clearly see is that the overextension relative to the 5-year moving average was up to 47% at the end of last year. And in 1997, it was around, well, it was around the same. And then we had the huge advance in 2006. It was 91% overextended. So this is a pretty big overextension, and we have stocks that are going up, but corporate profits that are going down. And then we have tightening liquidity conditions. So to say that we are late in the stock market cycle, I think, is the easiest way to describe it. But the other point, of course, is that late in the stock market cycle is often when you get bubbly characteristics. And then we should pay attention to what's happening to some of these leading AI stocks, because NVIDIA went vertical in here this week. It went from 300 to 400. So that's a phenomenally large advance for a big company. And the market cap is now knocking on the door of 1 trillion. It's at 962 billion in here today. And this is a company where the yield is a 0.4, the PE is 55, which is a lot better than 188. But then the price to sales ratio is 37. So when we think about the valuation that's being attached to NVIDIA, well, to say that it's aggressive is a gross understatement. And this is a company that has revenue of about 25 billion in the year to April, maybe 39 billion into the end of January 2024, and a market cap of 962 billion, or free cash flow of about 15 billion. So it's not a company that's losing money, obviously, but there's a lot of good news being priced in very rapidly. And now we're seeing catch-up plays occurring right across the board. So Marvell Technology basically said today that they're anticipating sales will double, and the share rocketed higher. So that's obviously a clear catch-up play. Well, AMD announced about 3 weeks ago that they're going to be making AI chips with Microsoft. So the share continues to rebound. And this is also leading the broad semiconductors index higher. So these are the more chip designers. Then we have the kinds of companies that provide the equipment to build the fabs and to generate the returns from those designs. So Lam Research has rocketed higher as well in here. And then until just this week, we've seen that microchip technology hasn't really been firing at all. But the chances are that a rising tide will lift all boats within the semiconductor sector. And of course, An additional reason why Nvidia has surged higher, it was because there has been panicky buying by Chinese consumers, and they're worried that access to semiconductor equipment is going to be further curtailed. And obviously, then that means that they're buying hand over fist. And then you have the additional point that Nvidia had to change the composition of one of their best-selling chips so that it would be less efficient, and so that they could sell it in China. And the upstart, the result of that was that Chinese consumers have to basically buy more in order for them to reach the same efficiency. So that has boosted Nvidia's sales, and it really does highlight that there is basically an arms race going on right now in terms of artificial intelligence. So not much heed has been taken to the commercialization, the speed with which innovation can persist, and instead everybody wants to ensure that they have a piece of this market, and that is what's helping to drive this demand. Now, this isn't going to last indefinitely, but certainly we've had a big swing of money into the AI sector this week, and there is no sign that it is over. And the thing, of course, about a bubbly environment is that it can go on for a lot longer than anyone really anticipates. And these valuations are extraordinary. So, ultimately, everyone who wants to invest will have invested, and that will eventually allow this the valuations to come down, but we're just not there yet. And most particularly with the yield curve continuing to contract, this is about the place where we can anticipate bubbly activity. And then let's I did highlight this chart last week. And I think when we think about Cisco, that it got up to a price to sales ratio of 60 back in the 2000s. And today, well, then it collapsed, and today it is basically around the same place as it was in 2001 and 2. So we do get these incredible advances, and they're followed by generational-long processes of P ratio contraction and valuation contraction, I guess, would probably be the best way to think about it. Then let's think about, well, what does all this mean for the wider economy? Well, what I find especially interesting right now is how some of these commodities are being used as proxies to bet on a Chinese recovery. And copper was higher in here today, and it's oversold in the short term, so it's steadying in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. We might see some rebound over the course of the next couple of days, but this continues to look like a type 2 top formation with a massive reaction against the prevailing trend and a period of right-hand extension. And I think the most important thing is that China represents more than half of all global copper demand as well as supply. Therefore, what happens in China is going to have a big knock-on effect everywhere else. And the H-share index was in negative territory in here today. And this is breaking down now. But what was interesting is that the Chinese market on the mainland was in positive territory, but it is the EV companies are leading on the downside. So XPeng and BYD were the worst performers in here today. And BYD is working on a very large downside weekly key reversal. So Warren Buffett has exited the company, and it looks like other people are being encouraged to move as well. So when we look at, for example, some of these EV companies in China, well, considering that they're the national champions, then we're seeing this really profound underperformance. And some of these EV companies in China are not going to survive, but it is the largest automotive market in the world. And When you see this kind of underperformance, well, it has to suggest that demand in the wider economy isn't doing as well as many anticipated. There's certainly the possibility that this compression that we've seen in Chinese government bonds is something that might not simply be as a result of the tight credit conditions that they've been running for the last couple of years, and it might be more representative of the deflationary forces that are starting to come through in China. So, China could easily begin to export deflationary forces. That's one of the reasons why some of the industrial resources have been under pressure. And then, on top of that, the renminbi has also been weaker. So, one thing I think is very much at the back of my mind, at least, is that the dollar's trend overall has been quite mature, and that generally the dollar doesn't tend to rally for more than about 7 years at a time, and on this occasion it was 8 years. So the dollar's rally is long on the tooth. But in an environment where investment opportunities aren't very attractive elsewhere, well, then there's the potential that the dollar can rally into that environment, because if people want to play, for example, the artificial intelligence theme, well, then the USA is still the leader, and that is certainly attracting inward investment overall. I think that might help to support the dollar in the near term. But of course, what we also have to think then about is that if the dollar rolls over, it will probably be in response to lower interest rates and a slower economic growth environment overall. And we're not quite there yet. So we might yet see the dollar rally further, and it is pushing up through the 200-day moving average in the short term. So when we think then about the outlook for gold, well, gold prices are unwinding at the overbought condition and steady this week in the region of the lower side of this range. I continue to believe this is a consolidation, and I thought it was rather encouraging today that silver prices have begun to steady also in the region of that 200-day moving average, and attempting to put in an upside key day reversal in here today, although I haven't got out and measured it. But certainly when we see it on the weekly chart, that's a significant tail in the region of that 200-day moving average. I think that the rally in the dollar will be temporary, and that ultimately the tighter credit conditions, lower corporate profits will eventually feed through into a recessionary environment. But we're still in a bubbly environment now for the technology sector, and this incredible outperformance by the largest companies, that's very much a testament to the broader trend of artificial intelligence. Now, when we think about one of the most convincing use cases, it has to be in biotechnology. And the application of artificial intelligence to the discovery of new compounds, the development of new drugs, that's a clear, easy to explain use case. But then they also have to be brought to market, and they have to be proven to be efficacious and safe. And obviously, that's a long-term phenomenon. And then the biotech sector tends to be interest rate sensitive. So there is a bit of tug or to and froing in terms of this argument. But more importantly, this is a lower rally high. And the Nasdaq Biotech Index continues to roll over. So it's not acting like a potential beneficiary from artificial intelligence. Now, we also have increasing dialogue between the USA and China, but not a lot to show for it. And I think the trend of reshoring, offshoring, nearshoring, friendshoring persists, and Mexico is one of the clearest beneficiaries. So the iShares MSCI Mexico ETF pulled back in here this week because the president AMLO sent in the Marines to take over a rail line and to take some property from Grupo Mexico, and there was a lot of angst in the market that he was becoming a bit too eager to take over private property. Well, an agreement was reached yesterday that the government would in fact be paying for taking over this railway. Now, obviously there are issues, and there is a question about the trend of governance. And I do think that there are two ways of thinking about this. The first is that a left-leaning government usually tends to be more control-oriented, and they do want to take over various parts of the economy. So they've nationalized lithium, and they've signed an agreement to export LNG to Germany. And now there's increasing appetite for expanding the railway across the, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce it, but the isthmus linking or the narrowest point at which the Pacific and the Atlantic meet. So that would then help to boost trade. But of course, the number one advantage that Mexico has is that they have a land border with the USA. They have a large population, lower wage rates. They also have the potential to attract a large number of migrant workers from Latin America, from Central America. And there's obviously then the potential that they're going to attract even more inward investment. And the inward investment is setting records so far in the first quarter of this year and likely to hit a record by the end of the year. So the Mexican peso continues to trend higher, and it eased for the first few days of our release last week and then started to strengthen up again this week. And that is certainly encouraging for foreign investors. There is a clear trend here, and it has now held this sequence of higher reaction lows versus the dollar, so the dollar trending downwards against it for the last 7 months. And it's just, I think, very instructive to look at the long history. There haven't really been any times when the Mexican peso was this strong relative to the dollar, and it does suggest that something very different is occurring right now, and that is something we certainly need to pay attention to. Of course, another potential big beneficiary of this reshoring, or I think it might be more accurate to describe it as China plus one, and that would be India. So the Nifty index is pushing up to the upper side of this 2-year range, and it does look like there's the potential that it will pop on the upside. Now, we don't have the same currency benefit in India that we do in Mexico, but the rupee was steadier in here today. Now, it is also just worth reminding ourselves that the times when the rupee does strengthen, and there have been several occasions when it has rallied enough to unwind its overextension relative to the 1,000-day moving average, well, those have generally coincided with some of the best performance in the Indian stock market from a foreign investor's perspective. And let's just put up one of those foreign funds. So, for example, the JP Morgan India Trust is beginning to push back above the 200-day moving average. But then we can think about the times when it has done best, which were, for example, most recently between 2013 and about 16 or 17, and then during the pandemic period. So, with the rupee just giving us a hint of easing up on the big decline, that should be beneficial for from the perspective of foreign investors. Of course, Vietnam was among the first beneficiaries of inward investment from companies migrating away from higher costs in China. And the Vietnamese index has steadied over the last 6 months, but it is not firing on the upside. It certainly has more challenges, and they've had a perennially weak currency as well. Then I think it's especially interesting what happens in Brazil. And Brazil was the first country to really aggressively hike rates. They have very wide positive real interest rates right now. And there is this new left-wing government who want to spend. And the central bank, blessedly, is still independent and is holding off on cutting interest rates despite the fact that inflationary pressures are being mitigated. And they're worried about the government engaging in a lot of excessive spending. But then they have enforced on the government a fiscal reform, and the government will not be able to raise wages within the public sector without running surpluses. So the real is hovering here, right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. There has been a very clear downward bias to the dollar's performance over the last 3.5 years, and there's the clear potential that the Brazilian market will do better if the currency appreciates. I think if we go back and look at that Bovespa index, not simply over the last decade, but just to incorporate the entire bull market, we can see that we had this huge rally from 2002 to 2008, and it went from about 9,000 to 75,000. But then, when we put that in dollar terms, then the move from those lows in 2002 was much more profound, where it went from about 2,200 to 44,000. So that's 20 times on the upside. And that was driven by the currency doubling. So when we then think about where we are right now, well, we've been in this long range for the last 7 years. And it really is a question of whether the real can appreciate from here. So we have emerging market currencies that are starting to do better, and they're looking more at the relative growth rates and the potential that these countries will benefit from rising geopolitical tensions between the USA and China. Then at the other end of the spectrum, you have Japan, where they are actively devaluing the currency. And the yen cruised through 140 versus the dollar in here today. So this is a meaningful devaluation of the yen versus the dollar. And that's helping to boost the nominal price appreciation of the Nikkei. So the Nikkei has popped up in US dollar terms over the course of the last week or two. In local currency terms, it is breaking up out of what's been a 3-year range. So this is obviously going to create demand for hedged exposure to Japan, but they are attempting to foment an inflationary bias. And that's going to be difficult. They have a. I was speaking with a friend of mine who is married to a Japanese lady, and they have young children. And they were living in Japan in the what I'm going to consider a mid-sized city of about 100,000 people. And that's where all the children are. So in the rural communities where there's lots of old people and all the young people left, there aren't any children. And in the big cities where living conditions are cramped, then there aren't any children either. All the children in Japan are in those mid-sized cities. And he said that he's never seen so many small children in one place. So what we definitely have in Japan are this balkanization of opportunity and living standards, and that the leadership of Tokyo, where you have a massive concentration of the population, then that's not necessarily representative of the entire country. But trying to break the deflationary mindset will probably take a generation. Because what you have to force people to do is to accelerate purchases. And we're starting to see that in several countries where people are accelerating purchases. They want to lock in the purchase today so that they don't have to pay more later. And then in Japan, I think there is a solid argument that it was basically impossible for them to create inflation in a globally deflationary environment. So now that they have global inflation, they're grasping it with both hands. Now, there is something that I've been thinking about over the last week or two is the question of debt. You've had several luminaries talking about the debt ceiling arguments in the USA and saying that this is completely missing the point because it is the fiscal cliff argument that is much more important and it will have to eventually be addressed. And this has been one of the bugbears of the macro community for years, that the benefits that have been agreed to, Social Security, Medicare, can't possibly be paid. And the fiscal issues and the volume of debt that several countries in Europe have are difficult. And that France, for example, is trying to fill a 2% hole in its fiscal balance and trying to extend the retirement age of their population, and they're finding it exceptionally difficult. Whereas the gap that the USA has on a long-term basis is approaching 7%. So that is a graphic representation of the privilege of having the reserve currency. But then debt issues are not limited to developed countries. So we can then think about what's going on in China. They don't want to have a property crash, but neither do they want to let the bubble in property prices extend any further. So they're restricting the availability of credit, and they're only doling it out in a piecemeal fashion in order to support the banking sector, but not to allow over enthusiasm take hold. And they've clamped down on the tech sector, and this free movement of capital isn't going to be tolerated any longer. So Alibaba has singularly failed to rally, and that is despite the fact that news is going to be broken up, and the p possibility that it is not quite worth more than the sum of its parts, that those some of the parts might actually be worth more. These are all going to be explored by the market. But I think the bigger question here is if they're not going to have a property-fueled economy, and infrastructure and property development represents a huge chunk of the Chinese economy, then there's a lot of debt tied to that, and we're talking trillions. Then we can look at the fact that in all of the money that they lent out to African and emerging market countries as a result of the Belt and Road Initiative, there is talk of secret deals being done, slush funds being created, countries having to deposit cash into secret accounts so that the lenders can raid them if there is any fall off in the ability to pay. Well, there is a couple of different potential conclusions. One is that China really needs the money now, so they're being less than generous with their lending. The second is that they want to create debt servitude. But I do think that when we look around the world, and it's been not unreasonably referred to as the everything bubble, where the price of absolutely everything has gone up, then isn't it reasonable to conclude that one of the issues that we'll have in the future is that every country will have debt issues? What's generally happened after major wars is that the winners have their debts forgiven, and the losers end up saddled with a debt deflation. So then if we think about the trend of competition between China and the rest of the world, and the debt issues that are extant in much of the emerging markets, and particularly in Africa, where they have resources and large young populations, then it does potentially represent a catalyst that when we think about the relative debt situation and the need to dominate economic potential and markets for the future, then it might potentially be a realignment of countries based upon the debt burdens, who the debt is owed to, fighting against the lenders, and the prize being that whoever wins has to take the burden of that loss. And I think that's certainly a potential outcome. So this also helps to highlight why there is this bifurcation between the OECD slash NATO and the euphemistically referred to as Global South, although for whatever reason they're including Russia in that. But then I think these are going to be major points of contention. There's obviously creditor nations out there, and even big creditor nations like China have massive internal debts. And then you have small creditor nations like Singapore. And Singapore is sitting in the happy place between major power centers and very much tied to selling asset management and institutional wealth products. And the index has been going sideways since 2009. And if we're going to have a big bull market in Asia and more wealth created, then that would be beneficial for Singapore. The fact that it's been rather quiet suggests that it might be a little premature. And that perhaps even if we have lots of money being made in the China plus one countries, the fact that China remains under pressure is a bit of a headwind for just about everything. So we're certainly in an interesting environment, and we still have tight liquidity conditions, and we're starting to see bubbly characteristics emerging in the high-tech sector, and it's also starting to create demand for startup type operations like in the quantum computing sector. So, D-Wave Quantum, for example, was up in an exceptionally dynamic manner in here today as it starts to play catch up with the wider market. Then, when we look around the world, obviously, there is a great deal of concern about what's going to happen with the carbon and energy production. And oil prices were quite variable this week. So, up one day, down the next, and up 75 ticks in here today. And you have Saudi Arabia basically threatening to cut back on supply and warning short sellers. But then you have the additional point that we're still in a tight liquidity environment, and the signs out of China aren't particularly encouraging. I think the primary risk is on the demand side. And this is still a downtrend. It has not yet broken the sequence of lower rally highs. And an additional, I think, note of warning is in the carbon credit markets. Now, these are government sponsored. And if we get a meaningful decline, you will have action by government to come in and support the market. But that is a new reaction low. And there's been a sequence of lower rally highs since the last test of 100. So this is pointing towards lower economic growth in Europe. And the German economy remains under pressure that they're looking at a significant change, that Germany has to reposition itself as a higher energy cost manufacturing sector. And there is this big argument going on between the heads of the major corporations and the government. The government is saying you really should not depend on China as your only strategy, and the automotive sector in particular is saying mind your own business. And of course, then BYD has overtaken Volkswagen as the largest car manufacturer in or seller in China. And Volkswagen is right on the lower side of its range. What we definitely, though, saw today was that Tesla and Ford are looking at collaborating on charging. So Tesla was up and is now testing the region of the 200-day moving average and the psychological $200 level. And Ford has rebounded as well. So Fords now are going to get access to those Tesla supercharging networks. So they're trying to create a market for their products. And this is a very triangular pattern for Ford. And the one benefit it has is that it's got an estimated PE of around 7 and it yields nearly 5%. So at least we're not talking about an aggressive valuation. And there is the potential here that it will start to attract attention. When we think about tighter and more attractive valuations, it is worth highlighting that the dividend aristocrats have been trending with a downward bias now for most of the last 18 months, and the valuation isn't especially attractive. When we look at these stalwarts of the dividend aristocrats, Coca-Cola, for example, has pulled back in a very dynamic manner in here this week. And it's just worth considering that it has a PE of 23 and it yields about 3%. Now, when we look at dividend yields for these kinds of companies, the times when they get bought, that's generally when the yield is around the 3.5% level. Now, I know that interest rates today are quite a bit higher, so that might not be as attractive from an investor's perspective, so they might hold out for a higher yield. But we're definitely at a point here where investors are looking at what the potential is and want to be rewarded more by dividend aristocrat or high dividend paying stocks relative to the allure of money market funds. So we could easily get a period of PE ratio contraction in the dividend aristocrat sector that will then create demand for this sector, because these are name brand companies that dominate their respective niches and have long histories of paying dividends and increasing those dividends. But obviously, they are best bought when those dividends are really attractive. And we're not quite there at the moment. So I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.
Thank you.